This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 102. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm glad you joined us. I am Jim Harmer, and I'm joined by my friend, Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you?
I am doing great. Christmas was awesome. It was just so much fun. I have, you know, a three-year-old and a five-year-old, and so it's pretty hard to do a bad job of Christmas. They're just so excited about everything. It was just an awesome, awesome time.
Oh, I bet it was smiles from ear to ear, but I bet you're quite busy, and we've been quite busy as well. We decided to do a little experiment here again on Facebook, so we posted and asked our audience on Facebook whether or not they have any questions for photography. So without any further ado, what do you say we get in on answering the first question?
Let's do it. And usually we go in pretty deep depth on these questions and really provide a thorough answer. We're going to have a lot of questions here, so we're going to go a little bit rapid fire on this episode.
All right. The first question I'm looking at stands out to me, and it's from Zachary. I'm not going to butcher his last name, but he said, if we have one piece of advice to give anyone, what would it be? That's a tough one. I think the first piece of advice I would give someone is make sure to know your camera inside day and night, because it's going to get you the best results for pulling off the shots. Because if you don't know how to change a setting on your camera, there's no way to know how you're going to correct a mistake you might be making.
Yeah, that's definitely good advice. Another question is from Nick Page. He says, I have two questions. One, lately I've been doing lots of exposure blending in Photoshop using layers. Do you have any tips or tricks that you use to keep the results looking natural? Absolutely. My favorite tip for doing that is after you're doing all your exposure blending, all your mambo jumbo in there, take an original of the photo that's barely been touched at all on a new layer and on top of everything else below, and then just play with the opacity. Then you have all your crazy edits, whatever you've done underneath, and you've taken one single photo on top, and you can just dial in how much of the effect below you want to actually see. And so if things are looking a little bit unnatural, do that, and quickly you can get it dialed into the exact amount of juiced up you want that photo to look. Then his second question says he's going to be at the Oregon Coast Workshop in February. That's our free photography workshop that we're doing in February. We have a bunch of them at improvephotography.com/travel group. And when we say we free, we mean they are free to go out there. And was wondering if you had any tips for keeping your tripod from getting in the tide and getting sand in it. That can definitely cause problems with tripods. What I would recommend is when you're out shooting, you just want to be able to get out there and shoot and not worry about any of that stuff. And so what I would recommend is go ahead and get it salty, go ahead and get it sandy, go crazy. And then when the shoot is over, take your tripod in at home and you can disassemble the tripods. I mean, really disassemble the whole thing and clean it out. And there are great tutorials online about how to disassemble and clean a tripod.
Great advice. I had some sand in my tripod in California, and I actually found some tutorials online real quickly, and I was able to rectify that situation in a snippet. And the next question we have is from Dave, and he said, for a basic beginning portrait photographer, do we recommend using constant light, which we also call available light, or whether or not we recommend using flash, umbrellas, softboxes, and much more? I personally say start out with natural light, learn the exposure triangle of shutter speed, aperture, ISO. So figure out how all those work together and then start bringing in any speed lights and things like that, because that's adding another dimension to exposure.
Good advice. Caitlin Piazza says she's photographing her kids and getting a lot of motion in the photos, getting some motion blur, and she's wondering how to fix that. You know, a little bit more of a beginner question. What I would recommend there is, obviously you want to increase your shutter speed as much as possible. And usually I find that people are kind of chintzing down on their ISO, and that's going to keep you from getting to those higher shutter speeds. So increase your ISO, go a little bit crazy, but if your photos start to get noisy, add flash. Flash pops really, really fast. And so by using the flash in there, it's as if you have a second shutter.
That is great advice. And Chris Eric asked a really cool question. He said, what are our thoughts on Peter Lick selling the highest ever recorded price for a photo for $6.5 million for that photograph? My thoughts are bravo. He pulled off a nice piece of work of art, and just the what he puts into his work really makes it kind of have its own intrinsic value.
Yeah, and you know what? What I think about this is I see a lot of people, especially lately, that are kind of in a war against rich people. And so we see things like this and we're like, that's stupid. Nobody said we should waste that much money on a photo. And I say, you know what? You know, it's a totally different world. If somebody has $6.5 million they want to spend on a photo, they have $6.5 million they want to spend on a photo. If you've been really successful, you get to pick any photo you want, and you can pay what price you want to pay for it. So I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome that he's been so good at marketing to been able to drum up the price like that. Totally, totally cool.
Very cool. And our next question comes from Crystal Ring, and she says she takes a lot of photographs and advertises on Facebook. She wound up with no one usually wanting to photograph anything. How can she expand or really fix this? So I think she's having difficulty with getting her Facebook advertising to be effective for her. Is that how you're understanding the question, Jim?
Yeah, sounds like a conversion rate problem. And
yes,
that's one that I see common with photographers. So there are two different ways to think about advertising. When you see an ad on TV for Nike, and you know they have, you know, Kobe Bryant or whoever wearing Nike shoes and doing cool Kobe Bryant stuff, they don't expect you to, because you saw that ad, run over to Sports Authority and buy a pair of Nikes. That's not the purpose of the advertising. The purpose of the advertising is to make Nike look good. So when you go to the shoe store, you look at the options and you can pick Under Armour or Reebok or Adidas or Nike, and you say, Nike's cool, I picked the Nike. If Nike stopped advertising entirely for 20 years, kids 20 years from now would be like, oh, isn't that old brand that my grandpa wore? And so that's why Nike is paying so much money for advertising, is they want to make sure they stay on top. Now, as a photography business, you can't afford this type of advertising unless you live in a very small market. You know, if I live in Caldwell, Idaho, and I just do a ton of different things, community events, I'm the sponsor. I have ads at the mall, all kinds of things. I just saturate Caldwell, Idaho with the message of Jim Harmer Photography. I can eventually become a premium brand. And I'm sure you can think of local companies, maybe from a little jingle you hear on the radio often, that have become a name brand, even though they're just in your small market. So there's that kind of advertising that's not direct response. What photographers are usually looking for in your advertising is a direct response marketing. You want to put $100 into Facebook or Google Ads, and you want to earn $500. You want to trade your dimes for quarters. And direct response marketing is fun because it's so easy to see if it's successful or not. You put $100 in there, and then you wait and see if the phone rings. And the way that you can tell if it came from your advertising, that the client came from your ad, or if you know they just found you other ways, is the way that I do it is I set up a Google Voice number. So if I ever get a number call through my Google Voice number, I know it was from that ad because I don't give out that number any other place. So if you're having a really hard time getting your conversion rate up, Crystal, I would work on the experience that they have once they're on your website. Something isn't converting them. Maybe they're not ready to buy yet. What I would recommend is get a good email list and work to get their email once they get to your website. Show only your very best work. If you're advertising and they're not converting, it means something is happening on the website where they're landing that's not convincing them to buy. So let's take a better look at that before we buy more ads.
Awesome advice. And our next question comes from Fran Della Porta. And this one might be a good question for you, Jim, because she says that she always shoots Little League baseball in an all manual, usually shooting through a fence and shooting a Nikon D800 with a 70 to 200, I think, f2.8 lens. And she wants to know if there's a better way or workaround. So you were in the stand shooting baseball, but were you shooting anything behind chain link fence? And what experience did you have real quick to help Fran out?
Yeah, shooting through a fence is fine as long as your lens is close to the fence and as long as there's no stray light reflecting off the chain link fence. If there's any light, it's going to create hot spots on the fence. It's going to reduce dramatically your contrast and sharpness in the photo. So get your lens close to the fence, put a little shade on the fence where you're shooting through, shoot wide open, and you should be just fine. Coincidentally, I wouldn't shoot in manual mode when shooting Little League Baseball. I mean, almost all those games are going to be during the day, and so why add the complexity of shooting in manual mode? I would just shoot in aperture priority.
I would too.
All right, Darren, next question is from Mark Richardson. He says, I had to shoot 20 headshots today in a small dentist's office. Ooh, that sounds awful. I hate the smell of dentist's office.
Me too.
They also wanted a group shot. I have a background stand that I bought and set up and a roll of paper. It was a big pain, though, and the group was too big to fit with the paper as the background. Any suggestions here and any recommendations for portable backdrops?
I think just going to improvephotography.com, taking a look at Jim's recommended gear for a lighting setup, the Cowboy Studio backdrops that they sell are relatively inexpensive to get you started. Otherwise, if you're in a pinch, you can definitely go to the fabric store if you want to, grab some black fabric, maybe some gray and white, and then make sure there's not any patterns to it, that it's a solid color, and then hang it and actually go MacGyver on it and make your own stand to hold up that backdrop to fit the size of the group that you're photographing in the dentist office. That's how I would approach it.
Yeah. And another option, you know, because it sounds like the problem is just having the background. I mean, we can work, you know, get something a little bit easier to use than paper. You know, if we're in a small dentist office, getting a giant roll of seamless paper in there, holy cow, that's going to be crazy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's a situation where it's just a lot better to use canvas. Now, canvas has its own problems. It gets wrinkles in it. It's really annoying to work with for that reason. But what I would probably do is just ditch the background. They're in a dentist's office and they want to look like dentists, right? And so, you know, make them look good, separate them out, make it look fashion-y, put some nice lights in there, and you can make it look awesome in the dentist's office itself. I don't know that we necessarily have to go to a black or a white background. And so if it's just impractical in this situation, then ditch it and go with something different.
Oh yeah, rely on your shallow depth of field, and I think that honestly, that'll ditch the background for you right away.
All right, this one is for you because you know something about this camera. Sony A6000, oh, this is from Kevin Sill. Sony A6000 with the 7200 f4 or the Nikon D610 with the 7300 millimeter lens for portraits, sports, and overall. What would you recommend, Sony A6000 or the Nikon D610?
In the order of the way he's listed, or as that Kevin listed them, I'd say portraits. You could get away with the A6000. It does a great job with focusing. The F4 lens is going to give you enough shallow depth of field to have that nice bokeh in the background. And then also sports, I wouldn't be using the A6000 for that, even though it's using a hybrid autofocus or system using contrast and phase detection. It's still not fast enough for sports, in my personal opinion. So I would definitely hop over to the D610 for sports, and then just an overall camera. Right now, I just have a hard time recommending someone a camera besides this A6000. If you're looking for a camera body and a good lens, buy an A6000 with a 50mm f1.8, and that's $899 plus tax in Nebraska taxes, but still, it's a great way to start, and I think that, quite honestly, that camera would suit all of the needs besides the sports.
Yeah, the sports question is funny. Every single mirrorless camera that gets released lately says it's the fastest autofocus ever released in any camera. And it isn't.
It isn't. No.
So far, DSLR autofocus is still beating mirrorless. They're getting very, very good. Some of them are excellent. But in terms of shooting sports photography, I'd stick with the DSLR for now. I think that's going to change and soon.
And I would agree, because Tony Northrup sent me a message on Skype after we talked to him. Him and Chelsea got the A7S and the A7R in the mail recently, and they said that they're frustrated with the focus system. They said they'll probably have to give it some time, but, you know, as Tony said on the show, sports, it's just not going to cut the mustard with those mirrorless products just quite yet.
Yeah, soon, very soon, I hope, but not just quite yet.
All right, our next question comes from Scott Halleck, and he says, what is your favorite way to share photography as gifts for the family and friends? Photo books, prints, canvases, digital copies on a CD or DVD, and what is our favorite vendor for printing gifts, ProDPI and others? Ooh, this is a great question. I think ProDPI is definitely a winner in a lot of respects, and so is Miller's Lab, but I think a tangible print versus the DVD or CD option is going to beat anything when it comes to that, because if you hand someone a CD or a DVD, it might go into a junk drawer and never see the light of day. But I don't really think you could go wrong by giving them a photo book or a print or a canvas, because it's tangible and they can appreciate it and actually see it on a daily basis, versus a DVD that requires booting up a computer, loading the files, and having to look at them by going through that process.
Yeah, agreed. That's not fun at all. One other thing that I would recommend is, if you're going to give photos as gifts, don't give them a loose print. You know, don't just give them the print on photo paper. You know, think about a canvas gallery wrap. You know, at least get a frame for it, or, you know, a metal print that can just hang straight on the wall. Something that's ready to go, because if you give them the loose print, then they've got to go out and buy a frame, and frames are not cheap. So, you know, think twice before just giving the plain print itself. All right, yes. Rob. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and one last point on that. When you're doing your canvas wraps, make sure you get the thinner one, because if you go with the real thick ones, they're very hard to frame, and it kind of limits the option for whoever you give that gift to.
Right. If you're just doing a canvas, if you're doing a gallery wrap, you don't even need a frame.
Exactly.
All right. Rob Davies, who I met in Iceland, came on our travel group trip, says, I'm looking for my next lens. Aren't we all? I shoot Canon. And he's looking for sports and wildlife kind of camera. He has a 7200-28, but needs a little bit more reach. So he's looking for something with a little bit more reach, but not quite, not quite to the expensive of the 200 to 400 that's over 10 grand. You know, you might look, Rob, at something like the 400-5.6 could be an option. Canon's new 100 to 400 would be a cool option for you. There are some lenses out there, but the thing is, once we go super telephoto, it starts getting pricey. All right, next question is from Dave Steckler. For basic beginning portrait photography, do you recommend constant or flash?
With that, I personally constant first and then flash if I need it.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. It's intimidating to start with flash photography because, you know, it's just such a quick pop of light that you're not really sure what the flash is doing and stuff. So I can see the argument for constant light, but when I've seen students who do start with constant light, the results are not great because you get a constant light and it's not real bright. And so your ISO is up usually high because you got to just use it inside. You know, you can't use it outside unless you have a battery pack. And even if you did, it's not bright enough for outside to make any difference. You won't even see the light really. So you're really just using it inside and it's not real, real bright. And so you got to crank up your ISO. So every time I see a newer photographer who gets constant lights first, the photos are noisy, they're dim, and it just doesn't look quite right. And they're usually smaller lighting modifiers too, because it's less light. And so for me personally, I would say just go with the flash, and then there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve. I think if you get constant lights, you're going to get frustrated and it won't work out as well for you. But I can see the argument for both.
I can, and I actually misunderstood the question. I thought they were talking about available light, not constant light. So yes,
I understand.
I would go the same route as you, Jim.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, Emily Straw says, hi, she's a longtime listener and reader. If you had an unlimited budget for travel and gear and resources, what would be your dream photo shoot? Emily, I just dreamed about this last night and the night before that and the night before that.
And the night before that and the night before that.
Ooh, I don't know. Right now, I have been eyeing Myanmar. I really wanted to do this trip. I would go to Myanmar. I would shoot the next generation of the Fuji X-T1. I really like the Fuji X-T1 because it's such a shootable camera. It has an aperture dial and stuff. It's small. It's just beautiful, but it's only 16 megapixels. So Fuji would just craft me this awesome 36 megapixel usable small camera, and I would shoot that, and I would go to Myanmar. I'd want a small camera because I do a lot of street photography. You know, I wouldn't want to be real showy. It's not the safest of countries. And so I'd wanted something small, travel-y, and for me, that'd be it. How about you, Darren?
I think Ireland. Ireland, when the hills are nice and green and rolling, I think that would just create just almost the most surreal type of photo. I've always dreamed to go there, and every time I've been to Europe, I've skipped Ireland, and it's either been the wrong time of the year or it just didn't make it across the pond to go over there. So I think that would be my dream destination, just because there's also a bunch of history there. I like architectural photography as well as street photography, but I think that I would just get lost in photographing the greenery around, as well as the castles and everything else that has aged over the years as mankind has risen up to where we are now.
Yeah, that's awesome. I might be going there in a couple months. I'm going on a mystery vacation. I'm so excited about it. We're going with my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and Emily and I are going. And we set a budget and everything, and they're booking the tickets and everything. And so we're going somewhere international. It's not in the United States, but we have no idea where we're going to go. We're just going to show up at the airport, and they're going to tell us where we're headed. It's going to be awesome.
Please let it be Ireland. Please let it be Ireland.
I know. It'd be cool. Marcus Johnson asks, how important is it to learn programs such as Lightroom, Bridge, and Photoshop in improving one's photographs? Oh, well, this goes to the next question too. Scott Jeffcoat asks, what would you do? Basically, what are three things to take you from mid photographer to a professional? And I would say one of them is Lightroom, like Photoshop too. But like, really go dominate Lightroom and learn everything you got that there is in Lightroom. Hint, hint, somebody has a Lightroom class that they spend a ton of work on, and somebody on this podcast will answer all your questions in the class if you sign up at photoclasses.com. But seriously, Lightroom is going to take you way ahead in your photos once you start getting them styled.
Agreed.
And another one that you ask, you know, another thing to take you up, go buy a flash and learn flash. Yes. You know, if you learn flash and Lightroom, whoa, you're going to see a huge, huge difference in your photos.
Yep, you're going to take the world by storm. I can almost guarantee it. Lightroom and flashes. Our next question comes from Haley Potter, and she says, I don't have a question, but I just think you guys are awesome.
Hey, well, I think so too.
We think so too, and we think Haley's pretty awesome for posting that as well.
All right, Bonnie Gresham Davidson says, best way to market and sell your photography. Ooh, really depends if we're talking about, you know, fine art photography or if we're talking about portraits. Either way, I think the number one thing is you got to get your name out there. And usually that's through your established network of people. You know, we talk about networking. Everybody knows it's important. Not enough people do it. So get out there and network.
Yes, it's all about word of mouth advertisement. We have another question from Reed Reagan, and it says, hi there, explain the differences between macro lenses, namely the Canon 50mm and 100mm, but any focal length. Thank you.
Oh, right. I can talk about that one. I just did a month or so ago, I did a head-to-head comparison of a bunch of different macro lenses. So definitely go check out that video on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/user/improvephotography. We have a video that exactly answers this. But short answer is pick the 100. I usually find those shorter focal lengths, you know, the 50, the 40, the 60mm macro lenses are just too short for a lot of practical use. A 100mm macro, in my opinion, is just about right on a full frame camera. Maybe go with the Tamron 90mm f2.8 macro if you're on a crop sensor. Sean Marie says, what's the best lens for a Canon Rebel primarily used for sports photography, such as basketball games or baseball?
I would lean towards just their current lineup. I don't really see any holes besides their older ones. I'd lean towards their newer ones like the T5, the T5i, and take a look at those cameras. The T3i might do
a good
job.
She's asking about a lens.
Oh, a lens. Oh,
lens,
okay, sorry.
For the Canon Rebel.
Yeah, best lens for the Canon Rebel. I think if you look at Tamron, I think you can get some really good lenses. Also, we already posted the Christmas recommendations. Jim posted the 70-200mm Tamron f2.8. That's a great lens, and you're also going to get a 1.6 times magnification effect on the Canon crop system, so that'll actually give you that extra reach you might need to photograph the basketball and baseball players from the stands.
Yeah, if I only had one lens to shoot basketball, especially because it's indoor, usually it's dark, I'd pick a 70-200, and the Tamron 70-200 is going to save you a ton of money, and it's 95% as good. So Tamron 70-200 would be a great choice. Another one is the Canon 200mm f2.8, another really, really good choice.
Solid choice.
Rachel Werner asks, how do you go about getting a legal contract drawn up for your work with clients? What would That's I be looking to spend on something like that? Rachel, spend nothing, for I have one for you for free. Just go to improvephotography.com/contracts, and I have a bunch of the ones that I use in my personal photography, and you can have them de grasa. I love it when I can say that.
De grasa.
Alster Hamil asks, what can we do as photographers to learn about color form from some of the great artistic movements such as Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. Okay, this is crazy. I was just reading a book on this today that answers this exact question. And that is, it's a book on Amazon about composition. There are actually quite a few good ones, but I am writing my own book on composition because I think there's a lot to be said right now about composition. And will he find it very quickly? Answer, no. I didn't find the name of the book.
We'll link Alistair over to it in the Improved Photography show notes. It'll be improvephotography.com/102. We'll post a link to that book for you, Alistair.
But it's good, whatever it is.
All right. We have Lauren next with a question. She says, my indoor pictures are always grainy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I found terrible. It. Vision found it? And Art, The Biology of Seeing. And it was Rick Salmon who recommended that on the Digital Photo Experience podcast. Vision and Art, The Biology of Seeing. Great. Anyway, go ahead.
That makes sense. No, Lauren asks, she says, my indoor pictures are always grainy and just all around terrible. I try the ISO and shutter speed stuff with no luck. It's always like they come out blurry, noisy, and how can I improve? So pretty much what I'm seeing here from this question is that we're getting a lot of grain because we're using a higher ISO and you're trying to adjust your shutter speed, but I'm not seeing the word aperture in there. So I think that the main thing I'd steer you towards is possibly shooting an aperture priority in these darker areas and shooting at a lower f-stop, the lowest one that your lens will go to, and then seeing if that helps you improve the photography skills. And then you can grow into full manual once you learn the exposure triangle and how to keep your ISO low as possible and work with shutter speed and aperture primarily.
Yeah, and if you're finding that you're either getting noise all the time or you're always getting blurry pictures, you probably need a faster lens. Go buy a 50mm f1.8, and I think this problem is going to go away. Yes. All right, Dave Miller asks, when a sports photographer shoots a game, high school, college, or pro, who owns the images? Can he sell them, or does he need permission from the teams and players? All right, you have the rights to the photos. But the people who performed the game have the performance rights. It's just like if I you know, go to the circus and I take a picture of a circus performer with a lion. Well, that circus performer and the money that they spend on that lion is a lot to perform it to look like how you photographed. So they are going to have the rights to that performance. I wouldn't worry about it if we're shooting a high school game. You know, if it's a public high school, you know, this is the government in essence that's putting this on, and you're okay. The only issue you're going to have is with the players themselves. You're going to need a model release if you're using this photo for advertising in a commercial way. When we're talking about a college or a pro game, a pro game, you're going to have a deal with the whoever's putting on the game. You know, when you get into the stadium, you're going to know what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do. College games, it really is going to depend a lot. Obviously, you are still going to need a model release if you're going to sell the photos of the players themselves. But there are, it gets a little bit stickier in that because it may be a state-owned school, and then that adds new issues. But even so, they're still going to have some performance rights. So it really depends on a lot of details there. But that should at least point you in the right direction.
Oh yeah, like when I was photographing Formula One, I wasn't sure. And what you can do with professional sports, call the governing body over the sports organization.
Yeah, they're gonna have policies.
Yep, they're gonna have policies. You got it.
All right, this one's for you too, Darren. Taylor Edwards, with Sony as a whole most likely going bankrupt next year, should I risk buying a Sony A7S now?
I don't really see why Sony would be going bankrupt. I know there's a limited number on lenses. I know that, you know, we have our reservations as far as why the mirrorless system isn't quite there yet, in Jim and my personal opinion, with what we're using those for. But I don't really think that there's not there's exponential room for growth with Sony. And I say that it's a tough decision on whether you want to buy the A7S. If you're going to be doing a lot of video, that's my understanding. The A7S is a video camera primarily, and the A7R does better with stills. I would go with the A7R, and I think you're going to save a little bit of money in that respect as well. But you have to really just do that, line down the paper, pros and cons. What type of photography am I going to be shooting? Is it going to be stills, video, et cetera, and see whether or not that A7S is going to meet your needs.
Yeah, and the lawyer in me needs to add a little detail as well. Just because a company goes bankrupt doesn't mean they go away. not even close. So if a company goes bankrupt, like let's say Sony did go bankrupt, it doesn't mean there's going to be no more Sony. Sony's an extremely valuable company. Even if they go bankrupt, which I know sounds crazy, but it's true. You know, there's going to be restructuring. They're going to do different things. But Sony's not, they're not going anywhere. They're going to continue to exist.
Exactly. I mean, both of us, you drive a Durango and I drive a Jeep. Chrysler went bankrupt and they're still around.
That's right.
Yep.
Haley Elmhorst asks, any tips for taking photos in the winter? How to protect your camera from snow and how to avoid temperature change condensation from ruining a camera? Well, don't ask me because the camera graveyard is right next to me, not mocking me. But how I would protect them if I did a better job of it is when you're going from, you know, in your warm car to outside or vice versa is even worse. Just put your camera in a plastic bag and then the condensation forms on the outside. Side of the bag. When you're out in the snow, just go buy a cheap rain cover. Just go to improvephotography.com/raincover and we'll have our recommendations there of some inexpensive ones you can have to put on top of the camera so you don't get it ruined. Alicia Krabus asks, have you ever used an extender or a teleconverter for reaching even though you lose f-stops? Seems like a valuable option.
We know how Jim feels about teleconverters.
Don't.
So,
I hate teleconverters. A lot of photographers, that's right. A lot of photographers use them. A lot of very good professional photographers use them. And even I find if you're using a professional lens, I just don't like them. I don't like seeing that lack of sharpness in the photo. I wouldn't use them unless you really know what you're doing. If we're using, you know, a 600 millimeter lens, it's like made to use with a teleconverter. And then sometimes it's okay. But even then, I personally just don't. I just shoot it and crop. But don't think you're going to turn your 50 millimeter lens into a 100 millimeter lens with a teleconverter. It comes with a lot of strings attached.
Very true. And speaking of strings attached, we have a question from Michael Angelo Martinez. He says, how do we feel about the integration of GoPro in the world of photography? So with that, I welcome any innovations, any new entrance to the market, because it's going to push the ones who are already at the top of the market to keep ingenuitive and keep innovative and keep pushing out better and better products.
Good question. Andre Moraes, who is a Brazilian, it looks like. He wrote a little bit in Portuguese to me. He says, please explain the need for filters in landscape photography, especially those that need an adapter like Lee filters, for example. Are they really worth it? You know, every professional photographer that I've ever shot with, you know, who shoots landscapes, has got filters in the back. And a lot of them are unnecessary. You know, it used to be in film days, you'd have to have red filters and green filters and all kinds of stuff for doing different things. Most of those things can be just done in Photoshop now. It's just unnecessary. But there are two that you still just got to have with you. One is a neutral density filter, and the other one is a polarizer. If you're a landscape photographer, you just really do need those two filters.
They're in my bag right now.
Caitlin Piazza asks, photography in motion when it comes to getting some good action shots of my kids in battle. ideas for that?
I would just use fast shutter speeds and enjoy the kids battling it out.
Yeah, and I'd probably scoop back if they're battling. If they battle like my kids battle, I would probably scoop back just a little bit.
It's too funny. All right. Let's see here. I'm trying to keep track of all the questions. See the next one. I have one from Liz, and I don't want to butcher her last name, but she's saying, for someone starting out in a photography business, mainly outdoor portraits of individuals and families, what lens would you recommend as an excellent overall lens that you could do both tight shots and fit a group in as well when using a D7100? That's a tough question. I want to go to the 24-70, but I also have been listening when I flew into here. An argument of not using a 24-70 and using the 70-200 as our primary focal length, because we want to have, you know, facial feature compressions, making the people in the picture look more compressed and smaller, things along those lines. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, all of that. Good. I think that's good advice.
Right on.
All right. Jesse Smith says, what's the best way to shoot portrait photography at night? She's doing some flash photography at night and needs some help with it. The biggest tip that I can give you for that is one light is going to be impractical a lot of times when you're doing night photography, night portraits, which I've done before and is really, really cool. Because you don't have any ambient light, you may just be used to, when you're shooting with a flash, that the ambient light, you know, just the daylight around you is going to fill in a lot of the shadows. Well, you don't have that anymore. And so you probably need to use two flashes, or a flash and a reflector, something to kick in a little bit of the fill light where the main light may be throwing some shadows. Otherwise, the shadows are just too much. They're too deep. There's too much contrast in the scene.
For sure. And Sky Sexton asks, do you think Sigma will update their 50-150 f2.8 lens at CES? They just discontinued it, but it's the only crop sensor telephoto lens in f2.8 that everyone said was the best. That's tough. I mean, it's really hard to speculate until after CES happens. But I mean, if it's a popular lens and they're discontinuing, it could just be a marketing strategy. It's really hard to tell until CES rolls around.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, wait around to that January, February time frame, and I think we're going to start to see a lot of those holes kind of get filled in a little bit. All right, Liz Padlin asks, for someone starting out in a photography business, mainly outdoor portraits of individuals and families, what lens would you recommend as an excellent overall lens for the D7100? So crop sensor lens for kind of overall family portraits. For shooting groups, I like the 24-70. Now that's an expensive lens. That's, you know, almost $2,000. And if you're shooting a D7100, my guess is you would want to upgrade your body before you'd buy that lens. So for a crop sensor body, I love the Tamron 28-75. It's like a secret that Tamron doesn't tell anybody. It's like hiding in the back of their lens lineup. They don't let the world know how awesome this lens is, but it's a great, great lens, and it's so cheap. It's like, yeah, you can get a used one for like $350. I think it's $500 new, and a just awesome lens, and it doubles as a pretty decent macro photography lens as well.
It does. My dad actually used it for some macro photography while he was messing around before he upgraded to the 24-70 f2.8 Tamron lens. So I would definitely recommend it. It's a great price point as well.
Well, we have talked about a ton of questions in this episode. It was fun to go rapid fire through so many of you, Thank you to all of you on Facebook who answered our call for your questions. I hope it was helpful. Hope you learned a lot of new things, and we will see you in another 7 days.